UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Well, we may be few, but the quality is very high, so that's good. Let's just bow for a moment's prayer together. Father, we live in a world where bioethics and medical ethical issues are very pressing. They're also issues which are in the public eye. And give us an opportunity as Christians to speak to and address and to challenge. And so we ask that as we seek to understand something of the developments in genetics and bioethics, you'll guide and direct our thinking, our conversation, our interaction. Father, we long to learn how better to communicate your truth to a needy world. Help us and guide us. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. When we're talking about bioethical issues, I mean, we could fill books with it. I'm not going to do that today. They suggested that I concentrate on particularly the area of genetics. And so that's really what I'm going to talk about today. Genetic knowledge, of course, has mushroomed. If you go to any grocery store, I've been looking for a grocery store and finally eventually found Spar here in Sopron. And, of course, it's very much like them all over Europe and America. You go in and you come to the fruit, and here are the fruit and here are the vegetables, and all the apples are the same size and the same shape, the same color. All the tomatoes, the same size, same shape, same color. And I go out into my garden, I look at the apple trees, and they're all different sizes and different shapes. And I look at the tomatoes, and there's some green, some red, and different size, different shapes. And I say, how do they do that? And then I go to the meat counter, and I look at the Scottish BSE-free beef. And it's very, very lean. There's very little fat. And I think, how do they do that? And if I go to the garden center and buy one of the new rose varieties, it's beautiful. It's got a quite distinctive color. And I think, how do they do that? And of course, how they do it is by genetic manipulation. And so we live in a world where in terms of plants, in terms of animals, in terms of food, we're already much into genetic modification. But of course, we're now able more and more to see the link between genetics and disease. And there are two things that we have to remember when we're talking about the link between genetics and disease. I have to tell you that I'm a constant disappointment to people. They recognize often my voice from the radio, and then they meet me. That's what's disappointing. And they say to me, you're David Cook. And I say, yeah, that's right. They say, but I thought you were tall, dark, and handsome. And I say, well, you know, two out of three isn't bad. Now, why am I the size and the shape that I am? Well, I'm the size and shape that I am because if you met my parents, you'd know why I was the size and the shape that I am. Both my parents suffered from heart problems. And so it's likely, now we know it's the case, that I carry not just one, but a number of genes which predispose me to heart disease. But of course, that doesn't mean to say I'm going to die from a heart attack. Whether or not I have a heart attack depends on diet, depends on lifestyle, and depends on exercise and the environment. So, of course, I was guaranteed really to have a heart attack. There are some genes which are monogenetic. If you've got the gene, you will develop the disease. Certain forms of breast cancer, if you've got the gene, you'll develop the disease. Huntington's chorea, you've got the gene, you'll develop the disease. There's a one-to-one correlation. But actually, those genes are relatively few. Most genes are what we call multifactorial. Whether or not you will develop that particular genetic problem depends on many other factors, like your diet, like your lifestyle, like the environment that you live and you work in. So it's important when people are talking about the link between genes and disease, which more and more, because we're mapping the human genome, we're seeing the links between genetics and disease. It's important we do not misunderstand that link. Either it's monogenetic, one gene, one disease, over and against multifactorial, whether or not the gene is expressed, when the gene is expressed, how severely the genetic problem is, will depend on many, many other factors. There are a number of things that we need to understand in looking at research in relation to genes. Scientists drew one very hard line. I say hard line a little hesitantly now because within the genetic community, people are saying perhaps we should revisit this question. What scientists said, and at the moment are still continuing, is that we will replace or we will manipulate genes in a single person's body for the benefit of that particular body. It's called somatic therapy. But germline therapy, which will affect not just this body, but the line, all the other bodies which might come from it, we will not engage in. Now, this was really because of a version of what's called the precautionary principle. If you don't know what's going to happen, don't do it. That's roughly the precautionary principle. There was a concern that while we might be able to control what happens in one body, we might not be able to control what happens in a whole series of bodies. So there was an informal agreement, never written down, never affirmed except by individuals, that we would engage only in somatic cells, cells within one body, and not in germline therapy. It's important we recognize that kind of distinction. Of course, the way that people are moving forward in the area of genetics, and we'll talk a little bit about what you do with genes in a moment, is particularly in terms of cloning. You'll know that Roslin and Ian Wilmot have become famous for Dolly. I was amazed to hear that people didn't know why the first sheep was Dolly, and that was because it came from mammary tissue, and they felt that Dolly Parton was a good role model for this, and as a result, Dolly was the name given to this particular sheep. Well, after 297 failed attempts, they managed to produce a clone, and Dolly, of course, was that clone. And now, of course, there is a clone of Dolly, though Dolly is sad, dead, and stuffed in a museum up in Edinburgh, but that's what happens to clones. A question was, should we then begin cloning? And in America and in the UK and in much of Europe, there has been great unease about cloning. The group in the European scene is called the Council of Europe, which is made up of 35 different countries. And they are really quite, in terms of bioethics, quite a conservative group. And they were very concerned about cloning and about the abuses of cloning. Always there's reference made to Nazi Germany. I'm not quite sure how you have Nazi Germany again if you don't have the philosophy of Nazism, but there's always that fear. And so particularly in Germany, there are bans on clones. But there is no ban on cloning part of human beings. And this is where stem cell therapy has become a major issue. You'll know that just 3 weeks ago in the United Kingdom, the first stem cell bank was established in Hartford, just not very far from London. And there are new stem cell lines which are coming from Newcastle and from King's College in London. And they've developed them in order them to sell. That's something that we often forget when we talk about bioethical issues, that there is, in fact, a commercial drive. There is a profit motive which drives many of the drug firms, much of the medical research in that whole area. We'll return to that question of medical research. Stem cell research is offering hope for people, for example, with diabetes. I'll give a specific example. In Mexico, they're doing a trial just now, taking islets actually from animals. They could take them from human beings. And they are encapsulating the pancreatic islets. They're inserting them into the bodies of people suffering from diabetes. If you come from Mexico and you are a mixture of the ancient Latin American tribes and a mixture of Spanish blood, you are highly vulnerable to diabetes. The average rate for diabetes among 16 to 24-year-olds is over 20%. And it's particularly marked among poor people. Because what poor people do is they can't afford to buy much in the way of food, but they do buy Coca-Cola. And if you want to develop particularly type 2 diabetes, Coca-Cola is way to go. that will really move you in that direction. It's interesting, in places like the States, the average is about 12%. So it's almost double the rate in Mexico, and that's because of genetic factors. But they're trying to develop stem cell research, taking encapsulated pancreatic islets, which will produce insulin, but not the antibodies which cause rejection. That's really the whole point in that kind of work. And so they hold out hope for people who are suffering from type 1 as well as type 2 diabetes, who are insulin dependent. And of course, if you've known anybody suffering from Alzheimer's, you know what a horrific disease that is, and how destructive, not just of the individual, but of the family and the community that seeks to support the individual. And so stem cells research holds out the possibility. Again, I want to emphasize that it's a possibility. There's a great deal of hype about medical research today, because federal government and state government has almost dried up as a source of research. And so the only research money you can get is really largely from private companies, particularly drug companies. And drug companies, of course, are happy to fund research as long as it's to their benefit. I'm part of Green College in Oxford, and we had a visit from a woman from Mars, not the planet, but the confectionery firm. And they wanted to found a fellowship, a research fellow, in Green College in nutrition, which is a very good and worthy cause. The first project they had for this individual was to investigate the absolutely crucial question whether or not eating Mars bars was good for you or not. Now, many of us didn't feel that a clinical double-blind trial was really necessary to establish the validity of this, but they went ahead and wanted to fund this. But it was funded on a particular condition. If we discovered by some miracle that eating Mars bars was good for you nutritionally or any other sense, then they wanted all the journals, all the medical journals, headline, Mars bars are good for you. If by some terrible tragedy we discovered that eating Mars bars was not the best thing that you could do, then they wanted that result to disappear down a black hole and never to be seen again. We explained to them that we were part of a university, and the university truth was truth was truth, and that even if the results were not very favorable to Mars, we would have to publish the results. And to be fair to Mars, they agreed to go ahead with the project, and they still do fund the nutrition fellowship at Green College. They've gone on to do other things than just look at Mars bars. One or two other questions. Research is often controlled, but that's not the only control over research. The Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, and now the Genetics Commission, are in charge of all research using human material. And it's interesting that more and more in the last 20 years, what we've seen are governments, national governments, international bodies, bringing in rules to control what the scientist, the medical scientist in particular, would do and to make rules. You'll know perhaps that in Cambridge, where they have a very good polytechnic, they tell me. But anyway, in the polytechnic, which they call university there, they wanted to create a center for animals, to develop animals for research. And eventually that plan has collapsed because it's too expensive to safeguard the people who will work in that particular setting. So there's a tremendous desire, particularly in Britain, where they spend more money on dog and cat food than they do on feeding children. It's a very interesting statistic. People are concerned about how we treat animals. Indeed, up until really the development of Human Fertilization Embryology Authority, there was more protection for experimenting with animals than there was for experimenting with human beings. And gradually we're catching up there. People are concerned to draw lines about what researchers may do and may not do, and to enshrine that in law, not leaving it to the good conscience of the doctors, the researchers, not leaving it to the medical communities, not leaving it to hospital research, but actually bringing in national legal standards for research. And so it controls what you are able to do with genetic material. Now, what we'd like to do is to manipulate the gene in a particular body. Let's say you're a young lady and you're carrying the gene which will cause breast cancer. It's clearly a genetic problem because your grandmother died of breast cancer, your mother died of breast cancer, her sister died of breast cancer, one of your sisters has breast cancer. The likelihood now is that you will have breast cancer. Now, if we could manipulate the gene within the individual, then we might be able to avoid breast cancer. That's what many genetic researchers are really seeking to do. That's actually very hard to do. So what we've been doing instead is replacing genes. We've been trying to develop a way of growing a, well, it's called a BRCA1, BRCA2, a breast cancer-free gene, or an Alzheimer's-free gene, or a diabetes-free gene. And you can construct this artificially. And we've even discovered a way of holding it in a medium where a patient can take it in. He or she, it's like an asthma inhaler. And you give them this little solution, which carries, we're doing an experiment in Edinburgh and Oxford, in cystic fibrosis, which you'll know is a terrible disease, which affects the lungs and the breathing, and often people used to die early. Well, we've got now a cystic fibrosis-free gene. We've got it in the solution. We put it into an inhaler, and there's a research experiment going on between 16 and 24-year-olds, eight men, eight women, who are trying to inhale this. One, to lower the effects of the cystic fibrosis gene, and two, we're seeing the rate of absorption to see whether it's possible that the body naturally will take in the good gene and will overcome the bad gene. It's interesting, we talk about good and bad genes. We have to be really careful about that. There are certain diseases which affect people from Afro-Caribbean backgrounds, and particularly sickle cell anemia. And we've identified the gene, and we could get rid of that gene. We could get rid of that gene, but that gene which affects a small percentage of people with sickle cell anemia also gives a natural defense against malaria. So what everybody thought was a bad gene, actually, in many ways, is a good gene. And so one of the reasons that they rejected germline therapy affecting the next generation was that if you get rid of a gene which we all know is bad, causes breast cancer, it causes sickle cell anemia, we might discover in 3, 4, 5 years' time that we have new, even more horrific diseases which were protected against by that particular gene. It's a wonderful example where in medical research, sometimes you become so tunnel vision, you forget the effects. I spoke at the Scottish Radiology Conference, and they had told us about their cyclotron unit. This was the latest kind of treatment for cancer. And they had discovered that every patient who came and was treated with cyclotron never came back with cancer. 100% success rate. And so somebody said, well, what happened to these patients? Oh, we don't know. They just never came back. It was not a problem. So somebody said, I think we should find out what happened. They discovered they all died as a result of the cyclotron. But the researchers were so keen to make sure that cancer didn't come back, they forgot to ask about all the other things that might happen. So medical research has to be looked at very carefully. Tunnel vision can lead to all kinds of problems. Gene manipulation, gene replacement, and then, of course, my own favorite area, which is my alleged area of expertise, which is not saying much, is I sit on the Xenotransplantation Interim Regulatory Authority. If you can say that in Oxford, we give people a degree. Now, UK XERA, the United Kingdom Xenotransplantation Interim Regulatory Authority, that's just to show I'm entitled to at least 2 degrees, is there in order to take organs from animals into human beings. What do you buy an 18-year-old for his or her birthday? You know, now the coming of age is not 21, but 18. Well, the answer, of course, is a pig. Not an ordinary pig, a genetically modified pig. And everywhere your 18-year-old goes, the genetically modified pig goes as well. Now, when there's a road traffic accident, this is when the pig becomes very important. You know, the British love to have their bacon and egg breakfast. And if ever you've had bacon and egg for breakfast, you'll know that what happens is that the hen makes a donation, but the pig is totally committed. And what you're looking for is total commitment on the part of this genetically modified pig. Your 18-year-old liver is damaged in the accident. a genetically modified pig and it's a liver. Your 18-year-old kidney is damaged, genetically modified pig donates a kidney. Your 18-year-old heart is damaged and the genetically modified pig donates a heart. And because it has been genetically modified, the body will not reject the organ. We've been able to overcome the problem of rejection, not function, but rejection, by genetic modification. I went to see the best-kept pigs, both in the United States and also in the UK. They are kept in very secure circumstances where each pig has his or her own sty. They're not allowed to meet with other pigs because they're too expensive and they might harm each other. The sty is made of soft plastic and rubber. There's a dunging area, a sleeping area, and a play area. They have toys, they have pipe music, they have a very special diet, and they see a vet 2 times a day. And all that is required for living in this land of piggy luxury is that if and when the United Kingdom's Endotransplantation Interim Regulatory Authority says, yes, you can take organs from animals, these pigs will lay down their lives for human beings. Now, of course, it raises many moral questions, questions about whether or not we should do this to animals at all, whether or not we believe that genetic modification is proper, whether or not taking organs from animals and putting them in human beings is something we should limit, whether or not we think there's a difference between having a bacon sandwich and having a pig's liver inserted surgically. How far do we go, not just in modifying genetically animals, but perhaps modifying human beings so that we can take the organs from animals and make it slightly cheaper for the National Health Service. I want us to step back from that reality of medical genetic technologies and to look at some of the underlying philosophies and challenges that it raises. Because, of course, we're not interested in just understanding the technique. But I want to plead with you. You know, there are many other workshops you could go to. But if you come to this workshop, I want to plead with you that you really try to understand the bioethical issues. Too often Christians have resisted becoming involved. They say it's a very complicated. I don't want to understand. I don't want to do the work. And so we leave the field open. Often I get calls from the BBC asking me to take part in this or that program. And I say, I don't really know very much about this subject. Well, that doesn't matter. They say you can still speak, so, you know, that's fine. And I think, should I do this about some subject I'm going to have to cram up on and get one of my researchers do some work on? And often I have to tell you that I say yes, not because I want to do it, not because I think I'm necessarily going to do it well, but to keep other people out. Because I know that there are some other people that they will go to who have a very different belief system, and who will be given a platform to talk often to millions of people, and they will come over as the most sweetly reasonable person, and this is the way that people will think about xenotransplantation, or they'll think about stem cell research, or they'll think about abortion, or they'll think about whatever the issue happens to be. And we need more, many more Christians who are prepared to do a little work and prepared to be in the media eye. I raised some money about 7-8 years ago, and I wrote to 35 evangelical leaders, and I said in the UK, I said to them, we have got together a team of BBC professionals, producers, interviewers, and we want to take you away for 3 days. We want to give you the experience of giving a scripted talk, taking a one-to-one discussion, and then taking part in a group discussion, and we will record this and we'll practice it and then we'll give you feedback. It's all expenses paid. All you have to do is to give us 3 days. And everybody wrote back and said, this is absolutely wonderful. This is a great idea. Thank you very much. But I don't want to do it. And the reason that many of them gave about not wanting to do it was they didn't want to get into the public debate. They didn't want to get into the public eye. Didn't want to be involved in tendentious and contentious issues. If Christians retreat from those kinds of areas, then we cannot complain about who is invited, what they say, and how they say it. So there really is a vacuum, and I believe an opportunity still within the world of the BBC for people actually to find a way of communicating on difficult issues. What are the challenges that face us? I want to suggest that there are a number of questions that we need to reflect on. The first one is, what does it mean to be human? Scientists are very concerned about the public understanding of science, and each year there's a major science festival which tries to encourage the public to understand science. And 3 or 4 years ago, they decided to have as their main theme genetics. They wanted the public to understand genetics, to be more sympathetic with genetics. And so they had a campaign in all the major London railway stations, huge posters which said, "Genes are us." Now that was very interesting, because here was a very particular view of what is human. You are nothing but your genetic makeup. What does it mean to be human? It means to be certain genetic makeup. What does it mean to be human? And do we believe that there's something more to humanity? And how do we express that? What does it mean to be human? What is our view of disease? Now, this was brought home to me. I had one of these telephone calls that I was referring to the other day, and this was from the genetics clinic. Here was a lady who suffered from Huntington's chorea. Now, you know what Huntington's chorea is? When I ask, do you know what Huntington's chorea is, there are two possible answers. One is yes, and that means we can carry on without having to explain it. The other is no, which means I explain it, and then we carry on. So we'll just do that bit again, shall we? Do you know what Huntington's chorea is?
Yes.
Most do, but one or two don't. Huntington's chorea is a disease which manifests itself round about the age of 30, 31, 32. It's a genetic-based disease, and it causes a particular form of paralysis whereby the brain is sending out messages, but your body does not act in light of the message. So you lose control. I had a relative who was put in a mental hospital because they thought she was mad, but she was actually suffering from Huntington's chorea. If you have the gene, you'll develop Huntington's chorea. This lady had the gene. She had one child. The child had the gene. The child would develop the disease. The lady was pregnant again. She'd come to the genetics clinic. She was having a test. And she wanted now to know whether or not this child in the womb was or was not a carrier of Huntington's chorea. She and her husband had come back for the result. The counselor had said, "Good news, the baby is perfectly normal." And she said, "Is it a boy or a girl?" And the counselor said, "Well, why do you want to know?" He said, "If it's a girl, we'll abort, because we do not want a female child." Now, is being female a genetic abnormality? In India, you can abort up to 38 weeks. So you wait to week 32, you have an ultrasound scan. If the baby is the wrong sex, you abort and try again. In China, one-child policy. If the child in the womb is the wrong sex, or even the child born is the wrong sex, you abort or you kill and you try again. It looks in some parts of the world as if being female is a genetic abnormality. What is abnormality and what is normality? I have a friend, Ian Kennedy, is a well-known lawyer, and Kennedy thinks there is a gene for being boring. And what we should do is we should screen the population and find everybody who has that boring gene and give them euthanasia once and for all. You see, it's a double problem. First of all, what is normal and what is abnormal? And what do we do with abnormality? And if we want to get rid of all abnormal, handicapped people, what do we say about the people who are handicapped, who are in our society, in our community? It's interesting that the lobby which is most opposed to genetic manipulation are groups of disabled people who are terrified that they are going to be even more marginalized, and that society has got such a view of perfection, that what is a perfect man, what is a perfect woman, that anybody who is less than perfect will be wiped out. And there are some interesting films and movies about that. What's human and what is disease? What is our view of life and death? The more I've been involved with geneticists, and I do want to say a word to defend geneticists. Sometimes people think that the reason we're all anxious about genetics is because you have these mad scientists, you know, all with tufts of hair coming out, and they're all trying to create Frankensteins in their laboratory. Nothing is further from the truth. Most people who got started in genetics did so because they had met and tried to minister medically, nursingly, to doctors, to children who were suffering from horrific diseases, genetic diseases. That's how many people got into the area of genetics. And their motive was to try to find cures. And people who are trying to find cures are very concerned to make sure that we overcome the problems of disease. But the more I work with these people, the more I'm convinced that behind is a terrifying fear of limitation, particularly of death, a fear of death. And so they want to resist death. As a Scotsman, when I travel, I do not buy a newspaper. I wait for somebody to leave one. And that's why it's always a delight to fly, because when you fly, they give you free newspapers. So this is a Scotsman's delight. And so there I was on Sunday evening, sitting in Heathrow, resisting the temptation to buy a newspaper, not finding any friendly person who'd left a newspaper. So I had to wait until I got on the plane to get my free newspaper. But I got it. And of course, you know, I read every line in the free newspaper. You've got to make the most of it. And what was interesting in the newspaper was an article about genetics. And this particular article about genetics said, we will all be able to live 200 years longer without a serious loss of function. Now, that's a very interesting question. It's interesting for each of us for a moment to reflect on whether or not we would really want to live 200 years longer, even if we were guaranteed no loss of function or little loss of function. But the thing that's been concerning me, and you know, I've been in the public arena saying, what kind of society would we have? People now marry and marry not for 30, 40 years, but now 50, 60 years is becoming normal. If they live to be 200, they'll be 200 more years, then they'll be married for 240, 260 years. Think about retirement. I'm not quite living for the day, but I mean, imagine there are many people who are living for the day when they can retire. And of course, what they want to do is to make sure everybody else keeps on working to keep them in the manner to which they've become accustomed. But if you're not going to retire until you're 200, what chances there of promotion? What chances there of pension? How long is that pension going to last? The social implications for our human community are enormous. We live in a world of overpopulation. Now, if you go to Singapore, they're offering financial incentives for couples to breed furiously. But here's, you no longer need to produce children. You can just make people live longer. Now, you might have more working years, you might have more productive years, you might have more people. Now, what are we going to do with all these resources, or the resources, in fact, which are running out because there aren't all these resources left? A view of life and death. A view also of reductionism. Donald Mackay was a very famous physicist, applied physicist, and he used to debate with Anthony Flew on the steps of Keele University. And he developed a phrase which I think is very applicable to genetics, and that is the nothing buttery problem, where people say you are nothing but your genes, or you're nothing but your economic function, the Marxists might have said, or you're nothing but your psychological issues, according to the Freudian. There are many isms which are reductionist. They reduce you to one aspect. Now, I just want us to be really careful here. The aspect that is reduced to is a proper aspect. Economics does matter. Genetics does matter. Social function does matter. Psychological attitude does matter. But it is not the only thing on its own. And so the nothing buttery takes something which is true in itself and tries to make the part the whole and fails to grasp the holism which we really need to have. Reductionism and also, of course, determinism. Now, this is where the social implications begin to strike home. Imagine that you are a light-fingered individual. I was very struck. Yesterday, I tried in the morning to have something to drink, and they only had coffee. And having passed the water cooler in the afternoon, I went out and found a store. And in the store, I bought a large bottle of Diet Coke, which you, if you were here last evening, you saw. And my bottle of Diet Coke, I carried around with me all day. The problem with these kinds of things is everybody wants to have a little word with you. And so everybody had a little word. And at one point, somebody had a little word with me, and I put down my Diet Coke bottle, and I went off and I did this session, and then I'd forgotten all about my Diet Coke, and I went off and had a nice dinner. And then as I'm sitting halfway through dinner, and I almost left my place because I realized I'd left my Diet Coke, and I had no idea where I'd left it. And I thought, now, this is a real test of the genuine Christianity of this particular leadership forum. And so I came back to see if I could find my Diet Coke. And there it was, exactly where I'd left it, just at the top of the stairs. So this is a tribute to all of you that neither you nor anybody else here helped themselves to my Diet Coke, which was interesting. If you are light-fingered, then is it your fault? Are you, in your genetic makeup, so conditioned that you have to? I remember taking part in a debate with Richard Kirker. Richard Kirker is the man who leads the lesbian and gay Christian movement in the United Kingdom. And this was after an announced discovery. It wasn't actually a discovery because it turned out not to be the case. But it was an alleged discovery that there was a gay gene. There was a gene which meant that if you had this gene, you would become a homosexual. And the Sunday program wanted a debate about this. And it was very interesting to me because here was Richard Kirker, who has long been an advocate of women's rights to choose abortion on any ground at all, saying, Dr. Cook, you always know it's really serious when people call you Dr. Cook. You know, boy, they're going to ask for something here. Dr. Cook, he said, I want you to intervene with the government to make abortion illegal for anybody who has the gay gene. And he was worried that parents, if they knew that their child was carrying a gene which would inevitably or even possibly make them homosexual, that they'd abort if there was no manipulation or replacement, because they'd rather have a heterosexual child than a homosexual child if they could choose while it was in the womb. It was very interesting how pro-choice disappeared out the window when he was confronted with that reality. The reality is there are a number of genes which are related to our sexuality. The reality is that these genes are multifactorial, and there isn't one gene. It doesn't mean if you've got these genes, you will automatically develop. But there is the idea that we are not responsible for what we do. And of course, our praise and blame. That was a really nice seminar. This is what you're supposed to write at the end of when the monitor gives you out your thing. Or that was a really terrible seminar. Now, of course, was it all determined? Or do you have a real choice? When you say to somebody, well done, you say well done because you think they achieved it. Roger Bannister ran the first four-minute mile. And when he ran the four-minute mile, of course, he had a lot of help to enable him. But in the end, he ran it. But if he was genetically modified in order to run, is this really a human achievement? Do we really praise people? Do we really blame people? Should we put people in prison? He's a rapist, but he's genetically determined to be a rapist. He has no choice in the matter. Crime is a matter of your genetics. Bad behavior is a function of your genetic material. We need to think very carefully about determinism. And of course, in a Christian context, we need to think very hard about whether or not we believe that when we present the gospel, people are genuinely able to respond to the gospel, or whether the hard determinism, which sometimes we've seen allied to particular understandings of determinism and theological, never mind genetic determinism, what do we think about determinism and what do we think about freedom in relation to that? Underlying challenge, I've already talked a little bit about funding. I think we need to, and I think governments need to be much more critical of funding agencies and the way that they limit research and the way that they control the results of research. I become more and more anxious as I see research going down what I regard often as a blind alley, where it's likely to be highly unsuccessful, but because there's a particular funding lobby which is pushing in a direction. This has been particularly true in the search for a response to HIV and AIDS. That the gay lobby were convinced that there were certain directions of research, and they publicly pressurized research groups, and it seems that that may well have been a dead end. And they're having to go back to basics and say, are there different understandings that we can have of HIV and AIDS that might be more fruitful in terms of finding some kind of response and some kind of cure? We've talked again about the public perception of genetics and the need for us really to make sure that people understand that we don't terrify people. I was thinking that if tomorrow morning you got a newspaper and we could read it, not in Hungarian for people like myself, and it said, determinism is true, whether or not it would make any difference to anything that we did. Whether or not, oh, determinism is true, so there's no point in me getting up this morning, there's no point in me having breakfast, there's no point in me going down to the seminars, there's no point in me phoning my husband, my wife, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, there's no point in talking to my children, because it's all determined. Or whether or not determinism would just mean we'd all carry on in the same way. Because even if it's true, it might be trivially true. Whether or not the fact that all is determined. It's a little bit like the Marxist who says everything is determined. And of course that means the Marxist statement that everything is determined is itself determined. And so it's no more true or less true than everything is not determined, which is also determined. And if both are determined, how do you choose between the determined and the determined? You'd have to be determined so to do. The public perception of genetics is very important, that we help people understand the limitations of genetics in particular. Much of the problem of stem cell research is that people with diabetes, people suffering from Alzheimer's or with families suffering from Alzheimer's, the Christopher Reeves of this world who are paralyzed, they are all living for the day when the cure will come. Even if medical research is successful, even if stem cell research or adult stem cell research is successful, the time lag between the research happening and it being available in the GP surgery or the hospital surgical context is going to be long, long, 15, 20 years. So Christopher Reeve isn't going to see this happening. People currently suffering from Alzheimer's aren't going to have this benefit. And it may never happen. And I think we need a healthy dose of skepticism, not to remove hope from people, but to be realistic about hope. It's peace where there is no peace, hope where there is no genuine, realistic hope or expectation of hope. The last underlying challenge I want to suggest, and I think you have to be really careful how you use this, is that of playing God. Interviewers have stock questions, and whenever some new scientific or genetic technique comes along, the interviewer will always say, isn't this just playing God? And I think there's often a kind of religious trap where this is religious language, God is invoked, so we can say, yes, this is playing God, isn't this awful? We have to be a little bit careful because if you take an aspirin a day, and I would urge you all to take a small aspirin a day, it clearly helps prevent heart disease and will affect the bad effects of heart effect, as long as you don't have stomach problems. I say that quickly because I know there are some GPs present who will want to make sure that we're not prescribing in the public context. But it's clear there's a link between taking aspirins and a positive benefit if a heart event does happen. All of these are ways, not of playing God, but of taking proper care of ourselves. And we don't think that when the doctor who studied and understands that the human body functions in a particular way and that there are certain treatments which are better or worse for people, we don't regard that as divine intervention. We regard this as part of God's good providence. And so we have to beware of using the playing God argument. I think what the playing God argument really does is alert us to there may be a point of going too far. And I think where that point is might be difficult to draw the line and enunciate. In genetics, I've drawn a very simple distinction, and that is between putting right something which has gone wrong over enhancing particular qualities. Now, it seems to me that it's not always easy to draw the line, but certainly when we know something is wrong, then we should be seeking to restore function. It's restoration. If you see somebody who's been severely burned, as a child, my parents didn't have a bathroom. They had a toilet, but not a bathroom. The toilet was at the end of the garden kind of thing. And so they had a tin bath. And they used to foolishly fill the tin bath with boiling water to make sure it was hot. And then they would add cold water till it got to the right temperature. My mother, in her zeal to make sure that it was warm enough, was away getting the cold water and didn't realize her little boy, who was just wearing a nappy, was intrigued to find this bath full of boiling water. And, of course, when she came back to the screams, here was I in the bath full of boiling water. And if it had been possible to give skin grafts, which replaced the withered flesh which I have, then restoring what had gone wrong. Even worse, if I'd fallen face, or you maybe think I did fall face first, then this is the best he can do. In the context of restoring function for people who've been severely burned, accident victims, it's horrific. And all of us would want to do that. But if some lady thinks that her mammary tissue is not sufficiently developed and she wants to have a larger breast size, or Prince Charles is worried about his ears sticking out, so we need an ear job, or somebody thinks their nose isn't quite the cute little turned-up version it should be. How far do we begin to manipulate the human body externally and internally? This was brought home by a series of cases, but my first was a student, young man, very bright, 30 years old, brilliant writer, but severe stammer. He could not speak. He was severely stammering in his speech. And he came to me one day, and eventually I realized he was telling me that he thought he was a woman in a man's body, and he wanted to become a woman. He'd been having counseling. He'd been having hormonal treatment. He was developing secondary characteristics, and now he wanted to have an operation. He wanted to have penis removed, vagina created. And he wanted to know what the college university's attitude was towards this. And I said, well, it's none of the college's university's business. And he went, he had the operation, and she came back to college. Now, people in the college coped very well with her. They coped so well that she couldn't cope with them coping. And she dropped out. She disappeared. Just disappeared one day. I had a very sad letter about 5-6 years later from him. From him, because he decided he really was a man after all. But we couldn't put back what we'd taken away. And the problem is how far you change the body. And we live in an age, you buy young women's magazines in particular, and look at the pictures of what is an ideal man, what is an ideal woman. And then you see why young people act, dress, want their bodies changed in particular ways, and they do harm, whether it's from anorexia, bulimia, or whether it's, I remember, one, some of you might recall it, this was a 16-year-old who was having breast enlargement from her parents for her 16th birthday. Now, whether we should be saying to 16-year-olds, there's something so wrong with your body that the best we can do, the best present we can give you, because this young lady wanted to be a model and she thought that she wasn't quite proportionate enough to be a model, but, you know, having an operation would make all the difference in the world. How far we play God, how far we begin to manipulate people and go too far, that's, I think, a very important line. I want to suggest there are some social challenges, because sometimes I think when we talk about moral issues, we talk as if they're quite clear and cut. I think there are some issues of confidentiality, which it relates to genetics. And I've been working with Ian Kennedy in the British Insurance Company looking at this question. Your genetic information is very important. It's very important to an employer. Should I employ you if I know that by the time you're 30, you're going to have Huntington's chorea? By the time you're 40, you're going to have cancer of the colon? By the time you're 50, you're going to have heart disease? Employment. Insurance. should I give you life insurance or health insurance if I know that 30, 40, 50, you're going to have these various diseases? Mortgage. Should I give you a 25-year mortgage if you're only actually going to be able to function for 10 years and your genetic profile tells me that? Your and my genetic information is constantly desired by insurance companies, by employers, and by mortgage companies. But don't worry, your information, my information, is confidential. And the great thing about confidentiality is that in any major hospital, only 163 people have access to your or my confidential file. And this is slightly worrying. I used to live in a little village just on the edge of Oxford, and there was only one health centre. And I don't know why they call it health centre, because you only go there when you're ill, but I went to the health centre, and the receptionist says, "Oh, hello, David, come to see the doctor." And I said, "That's right, I've come to see the doctor." And so she says, "David Cook's come to see the doctor." So the secretary goes to the file and takes out my file and hands it to the nurse, and the nurse takes it down to the GP, and I go in and see the GP. And we have a confidential consultation. And he scribbles something down, which is usual GP writing, which cannot be read, and hands it, you know, back in with the file to the nurse. Nurse takes it back, gives it to the secretary to type up, and the secretary says, "I can't read this. Anybody help me?" And so everybody says, "I think it means this and this." And then the next day, I'm wandering through the village, and I meet the receptionist, and she says, "Hello, David. How are you?" Now, when she asks that question, "How am I?" I'm wondering whether or not my confidential medical information is absolutely confidential. Confidentiality of our genetic information will have tremendous significance, not just for our health and well-being, but actually for our economic, our financial, our entrepreneurial functioning. Issues about confidentiality. Issues too about how our genetic information will be used. I've tried to give you some examples of how parents might feel the desire to get rid of the wrong sex of child, how they might feel the desire to get rid of a child whose sexual orientation was one way rather than the other, how they might feel the desire to get rid of a child who is very likely or who is absolutely guaranteed to have some kind of genetic problem. Never mind about the parents who want to get rid of that. What about the pressure from society in a strapped health services world to say you're not going to be allowed to have children? In the Orthodox Jewish community in New York State, when you're 16, you have a test for Tay-Sachs disease. Tay-Sachs is a genetic disease. It's a kind of floppiness of the child. Child dies young. The results are confidential. Now, when you want to get married, engaged, you don't kind of go out looking for a piece of talent. What you do instead is you employ a matchmaker. Matchmaker's first question, what is your Tay-Sachs number? Phones up the genetic information bank. I've got number so-and-so, and I'm thinking about making a match with this number, and this number. If they were together, would they produce a Tay-Sachs child? If you would, they will not marry you in the Orthodox community in New York State. If you live in Cyprus, there's a childhood disease, again, floppy development, called thalassemia. You can't get married in the Greek Orthodox Church unless one of you has a thalassemia-free certificate. Here are religious communities, in the name of public health, saying, we will control the marriage possibilities. Now, once you begin to control the marriage possibilities, why not control the fertility possibilities? Why not control whether or not a woman will be allowed to carry a child to term? So there is the problem of what we do with genetic information, what we do in terms of discrimination, how we understand abnormality, and how we, as religious communities, look at that. I have a whole series of principles which, if you all got the handout, we won't bother going through, because I want to make sure that we have time, and in a moment or two we will die in terms of the video, and then they'll seek to replace it so that we can have continuous help. You're very kindly going to be of benefit not just to each other and to me, but also to other people, because somebody somewhere will have the video. I often wonder why people video or tape record me, but I know the answer to that, and that is because it's the only way they can switch me off. And that feeling of power over Cook is a tremendous thing. I've suggested various principles here and responses in ethics and theology. These are meant to be what is loosely called starters for 10. They're kind of points to begin a discussion. But I'm more interested, I have to say, in looking at these questions, six questions at the end, and I don't want to work through them in some sort of legalistic way. I'll give you a minute to look at the questions, and then pick, and we shall together run at them. So is there any one of the questions particularly that we want to start with? Or a different question, you may have questions of your own. The six were not meant to be exhaustive. Is there anything that wasn't clear that you didn't understand? Is there anything that you wanted to ask about? Was there anything you wanted to see in light of the analysis? Go.
Yeah, I wonder if you could just expand on what you're saying with Tay-Sachs disease.
Right.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, my opinion is that isn't it interesting that a religious community wanting to preserve its well-being, and preserve its well-being in two senses, preserve its well-being in the sense of making sure that the members of that community are whole. I don't know whether you've ever had the opportunity to go to Israel, but one of the frightening things is to go to the town of Samaria. And you know about the Samaritan woman at the well, and there's only one spot where the well could have been, and so you know this was a place where Jesus actually was, and here are the two mountains, the mountains of blessing and cursing, so it's a tremendous atmosphere. But the trouble with Samaria is the Samaritans, and the trouble with Samaritans is there are only about 460 of them, and almost all of them are severely malformed. And why are they severely malformed? Because of inbreeding. And it's interesting that the leader of the Samaritan community, the mayor, is the one who is the least handicapped. They have created a public face which looks, quotes, normal. But actually, all the other, and the children, of course, have been taught how to beg. And they've been taught how to beg by showing you their particular deformity. And of course, visitors, largely Christians, drawn to this particular part, feel so horrified that they respond in that kind of way. So, you know, here's a community, an Orthodox Jewish community, which is saying, we are going to make sure we do not have this kind of problem in our community. But then it takes that second stage, where it says, we are actually going to control our members. Now, I spend much of my life talking at pastors' conferences. And one of the things that I talk to pastors about, what kind of marriage preparation do you do? And I ask them whether they ever refuse to marry anybody. And most have never refused to marry anybody. So I say, well, why do you bother with classes? If you're going to marry them anyway, what's the point in this? What are you trying to do? Now, here's a community which says, we're not going to marry you. We're going to draw some lines. No, that's very interesting to ask whether or not in the Christian community we would actually want to draw some lines, whether in the human community, the social community, we want to say, actually, to protect the well-being of the community, to protect health care costs, we're not going to allow handicapped children to be born. Now, that's a very, very slippery slope, and I think we need to reflect on that.
I'm just thinking about it. I haven't really heard of that situation before, but it's clearly different to saying you've got a baby with Down syndrome that's aborted.
Right, right.
The baby actually exists.
Oh, yeah, this is preventative.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if you're saying, like in a situation where you both have sickle certificates or Down syndrome certificates,
right.
And you know, there's two people who want to get married, but they're saying, no, we will not marry you.
Right.
The Tay-Sachs one would seem a pretty good way of dealing with it if you're going to go down that route, because even before the couple of even know who's being considered.
Right.
You know, they're in a tenant matchmaker society where
right.
children sign up to this matchmaker thing, and the matchmaker just saying, well, look, let's just.
That's right. This is not a couple who have already met and are kind of halfway down. And some of the fear is, you know, there are lots of dating agencies now. Well, instead of dating agencies, it's going to be genetic profiling. And so you're going to, you know, send me your genetic profile. We'll see whether or not we are or are not compatible. And, you know, boy, oh boy, are you genetically compatible? Yo-ho! You know, I'm not quite sure. It doesn't quite have the ring of it, but, you know, we could maybe try it. Yeah. I'm interested in other people's response to the T-sex.
Do they have to have the test for T-sex? Have to go on?
Yes, because they're 16. Yeah. Yeah, they do have to give the information.
And presumably, if you were in that community, you thought, I just don't want to go down this route, I've met someone that I really like.
Mm-hmm. Then you marry out.
Then you pretty much have to leave the community.
That's right. We're going to finish at this point so they can change the tape and then pick up again. But for the sake of the tape, we'll just stop. It's good to have this natural interplay that we have at this moment in time.
The really dirty
part, that's right. Okay. Right. Thank you. So, I don't know whether other people have responses to this question about whether or not communities should draw some kind of lines and limits to what kind of marriage should be permitted in order to ensure that genetic handicap will neither affect the ones who would suffer from it, nor the community, which would have to bear not just the financial cost, but the emotional cost, the social welfare cost.
It's difficult, though, assuming that the presence of that genetic handicap is a uniformly negative thing.
Right.
I mean, I guess it's hard with Tay Sachs because they do die very young.
Yep.
Thalassemia, though, they would go on until their... in Cyprus, probably until their teens, 20s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to say that, although it would be emotionally and financially difficult, their presence in that society would be uniformly negative,
mm-hmm.
I think is a hard thing to say.
Mm-hmm. But it's what some communities are saying. You know, it's interesting where you draw the line and on what particular diseases. Because that's the thing we've been working with insurance companies, saying, all right then, there are some genes that we know have links. And clearly, if you give a medical history, you'll be able to work out what those genes are. So it's not improper for the insurance company to have that information. But whether or not you are entitled to say, I will only give you insurance if you have this, this, and this test, and you've got to pass them all. And so they have agreed at the present time, informally, that they will not ask for tests, and that they will only request information which is already existing about certain genetic diseases. Not all possible genetic diseases, but just the ones where we're clear there is a one-on-one link. And there are only five that they're using at the present time. So it's a setting of limit, but it's, you know, how long is a piece of string? It's not easy.
There's all sorts of different issues, aren't there?
Right.
There's they're having the information, there's compelling people to do something with the information.
Right.
And then there's the what people would do if they weren't compelled in terms of fashion or just behaviour and sort of peer pressure.
Right. And part of that is how we regard freedom. I mean, it's interesting you say peer pressure, because peer pressure is that freedom. You know, am I really free? I had two boys, and they had two crosses to bear in life. One was that they looked like me, and the other that they lived with me. Now, here were two boys who had just 18 months between them, and one wore skin-tight jeans. You painted them on. And the other wore flared trousers. And so I would say to the skin-tight jean one, why on earth are you dressed like this? And he'd say, everybody does it. And say to the one who was wearing the flares, I'd say, why are you dressed like this? And he'd say to me, everybody does it. Now, you don't need an Oxford degree to know that it's not logically possible for them both to be correct at the same time. But the peer group pressure was great strong. And yet they would say, I chose to do this? Now, did they choose? Was this really an exercise of freedom? And are we really doing anything differently from that? So you're right about the many layers, and that's the difficulty about ethical issues, that there are many, many layered. In Oxford, in the university, we have a thing called the moral case, where you have to write up a moral case, and people have to analyze it, and they're given 1 hour to analyze the moral case. And the good case that you construct is one where there's a layer, and then they answer that, and then there's another layer, and they've got to answer, and then there's another layer. And every time you put, so like an onion, there's always another layer, and another layer, and another layer, really drawing people in to show that they can actually reflect in a multifarious way rather than just a univocal, one-level kind of response. Okay?
It seems to me that the problem is most judge whether something is morally correct or not, then we don't have a base.
Right.
And we as Christians have one.
Right.
So I would be interested to listen to your opinion about how we could start thinking about biblically thinking. Well, whether some things like gene replacement or xenotransplantation transplantation or things like that are morally correct according to the light of the Bible.
Well, I think that what we'd want to do is to look at the whole of Scripture, first of all, and not just to kind of pull out one text. The danger often about ethical issues is that people look for one text. Give an example last night, Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. And people just have the one text. So I'd want to look, first of all, at God's pattern in creation. Why I want to begin there is that's because where God began, but it's also where Jesus began. When he was confronted with a dilemma and people said to him, well, you know, what are you going to do about this woman who's been married to all these different men? What do you do about divorce? Jesus says from the beginning, he goes back to God's creation pattern. And so we need to go back to the creation pattern and say, is there something in our understanding of God's creation where he reveals certain standards? And, I mean, I think there are things about responsibility, there are things about answerability, there are things about being made in the image of God, which gives worth and value and dignity. There are things about the way in which God's natural law, an awareness of right and wrong, that Paul in Romans talks about, God has written his law on the hearts and minds of men and women. All of that is part, I think, of an understanding of creation. But we live in a fallen world. And so we then have to say, in light of God's creation patterns, what does the fall have to say about that? Now, of course, God does not leave us in just a fallen state, as he didn't leave the children of Israel. He then gave them the law. The law is not given for ideal people. It's given for fallen people, fallen men and women living in a fallen world. And so we can say about the law, as Jesus said about the law, what is the point behind the law? It's not, you know, here's the Sabbath day law. What's the point behind the Sabbath day? The Sabbath day is there for the benefit of humanity. It's not for its own sake. It has some other purpose. God's law is always for the good of people and to prevent harm to people. And so we can look then to the law. And so I think we can go through the Old Testament in that kind of way. And then we can look at the New Testament and ask whether or not Jesus has any specific teaching or whether the church has any principles that can be derived on moral issues. Because crudely, most of the epistles would not exist if there was uniformity in the early church. The early church had lots of disagreement, whether it was about do you need to be circumcised or not? Do you need to be kosher or not? Do you need to observe festivals or not? Is it proper to pray to God using somebody else than Jesus? All of these were issues that divided the early church. And so Paul and others in letters actually address these issues. And more importantly, I think, they address how to address the issues. They give us some basic principles, and you know, I don't want to turn this into an ethics seminar, but if you read Romans 14 and Romans 15, I think you'll find how do we cope with disagreement and moral issues. I think Paul gives us some guidelines that we can work through. Is this right? Is this wrong? How do we respond to issues in this kind of way? So that's what I'll be trying to do. But I think in the community, what we're trying to do, and what I've written down here in relation to number 4, is to explore whether there's any common ground. I was always struck by Lewis, C.S. Lewis. They used to ask him the question, why are there so many good people outside the church? And he would say, well, because they're made in the image of their Heavenly Father. And then he'd say, why are there so many bad people inside the church? He'd say, well, it's the best place for them because there's some hope they'll be changed. Now, I think we want to hold to both of those things. That if we believe Paul is right in Romans, that God has written his law in hearts and minds of people, then there is some common grace, there is some common morality, there is some sense of right and wrong that people have. I was always amazed doing this regular Moral Maze program. The others were not Christians. And they had a style of speaking which we'll say was pretty blasphemous, and swearing was quite often the norm. Whenever I was present, they would always apologize. Sometimes I would say to them, why are you apologizing to me for talking the way you always talk? Oh, because it's disrespectful. They knew there was something wrong with that way of talking. It's very fascinating to find people who were secularly highly successful, had got beyond the stage and certainly didn't always, some of them hated religion. Nevertheless, there was this sense of there's some things which you ought not to do. Now, you can say it's social conditioning, though it weren't always the same thing, so I'm uneasy about that, and he came from a variety of social settings. But there was still that sense of right and wrong. I remember we did a program after a particular horrific murder. Jamie Bulger was a little boy, 2-year-old, who was murdered by two preteens in Liverpool. And there was nobody who was not deeply hurt, deeply offended, thought this was absolutely tragic. I've never met anybody who thinks, child abuse is a great thing. Raping women is absolutely wonderful. Come on, let's all rape a woman, you know. This is just not the way that people think. There's a common grace there. And I think in apologetics, there's a bridge. There's a bridge that we can build in looking at moral issues. I remember taking part in a program about a movie. This was Hannibal Lecter. And I thought long and hard about taking part in this program because I knew I couldn't take part in the program unless I saw the movie. And they had a private showing for the three of us who were going to take part in the discussion. And the person who was opposed to me, as it were, was a film producer. He made these kinds of movies. And we watched it and all the rest of it. And then you have the audience. This is kind of... it's called Central Weekend Live. It's like a bear pit, really. And they give them alcohol to wind them up, and they have a man who goes in and winds them up before the program actually starts, and then it goes out late at night, and it can be pretty ferocious. But the presenter, a guy called Nicky Campbell, says, come on, David, you know, surely there's nothing wrong with this, you know. I said, Nicky, you have a daughter. And I knew he had a little girl. He says, yes, I love my daughter. I says, do you love her enough to make sure she never sees that kind of film? And, you know, as a father, he certainly wanted to make sure his daughter did not see it. I says, why is it all right for you to watch the film and not your daughter to watch the film? And you're trying to find ways of building on that common morality, not because you think that's the end, but because it stops and makes people think. It makes them draw lines. And then you can ask, why are you drawing the line there, and I want to draw the line here? So what's the difference? Which is the better line to draw? And where do you get your morality from? Where do I get mine from? And so I think there's an opportunity to use the common ground as a means of proclamation. As a means of proclamation. That's really, I think, what...
Are there different sorts of kind of ways of approaching bioethics? And one of the problems I have is that the closer you get to any problem, the more you find out, the more difficult it is to have an opinion about it. And you end up sort of thinking, you find out a lot one week, and then you find out something else the next week, and then you find you switch views. Are there kind of, from a Christian point of view, are there the sort of big picture bioethics where we say, okay, we may disagree about the finer points of abortion, whether or not the life begins at conception or whatever, but generally speaking, all Christians disagree with abortion on principle. Are there kind of big picture things that we can kind of fairly easily say that's straightforward, and then small things that we just get caught up in?
I think there are. I think there are two different levels here. I think that, as you'll know, working in a hospital or working in a GP setting, you do not have the luxury of spending forever trying to make up your mind. When the hospital phone me up and say, we have a couple in front of us, this is what we're talking about, what are we to say to them? I can say, well, give me a week to think about this. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, they need an answer. And so I think that there's something about reality that means we have to respond. And I think as Christians, we try to do the best that we can. We try to do it in light of looking God in the face and understanding. And that's why I think Romans 14, 15 is helpful, because I think it does give us a way of making a decision. But I think there are some general overall arching truths that we can affirm. And I think what's interesting to me is that nobody's really sat down and put them together. And I think that actually human dignity is important, that human life is special, and that we ought to be particularly protective of the vulnerable at the beginning of life, at the end of life, that we want people to be restored and whole people rather than reduced and diseased people. I think there are things that we can affirm, and I think that from those principles, certain things will follow and certain things will be forbidden. Now, there will be variations and there will be hard cases, but hard cases don't make good general law, as exceptions don't make good medicine. You know, in the medical field, you know, I try to encourage the medical students to say, well, as in practice, you have to be prepared for a surprise, but it will be surprising. You know, there's a general way that you can treat, and that will work out most of the time. So in medical ethics, there's a general way that you should relate. Sure, there might be some exceptionally difficult, complex moral issue that I can think up or will confront you, but that doesn't mean to say you throw it all away. And I think sometimes we become so paralyzed by the really hard, difficult, you know, weighing up, that we forget there are some general truths that we can affirm, which will give us general living principles. I think that's the important thing.
With regard to primary issues and secondary issues within Christian thinking, how do you think it applies to bioethics? I mean, clearly there are some issues where, you know, if you're talking to a Christian and you disagree on that, you know, it would be legitimate to say to break fellowship with him and say, I'm sorry, I can't.
Yes, I think that if I find that people are not concerned about human life, they're not concerned about human well-being, they're not concerned about the whole person, then working with them, and if you like, fellowshipping with them, is very difficult, because we have to have a certain amount of common ground. I always remember Alan Redpath and Philip of Hacking speaking together on the same platform. One was an Anglican, Episcopalian, and the other a Baptist. And they said very sweetly, we disagree about how much water, where you should apply it, and when you should apply it. But we're agreed that Christ is the Lord. And it was very interesting that it's whether what divides us is more important than what binds us together. And I'm looking for the glue that binds us together. And if I can work with people, if I can work with non-Christians, if I can work with people who do not share my Christian beliefs but are concerned to restrain evil and reinforce good, I want to work with them. It doesn't mean to say we're going to go to church together. It means that we're going to work to restrain evil and to reinforce good. So we need to understand what we're doing with people who perhaps don't sign up to every jot and tittle, who don't agree even with the broad principles. That doesn't mean to say that there's nothing that we can do and nothing that we can say in those contexts. We have one last comment from somebody.
With the common ground thing, have you had much experience with the sort of interfaith groups like the Christian Muslim uniting against the common ground?
Yes, I've been very interested, particularly with Muslims. With Jews, it's in one sense easier, more difficult, because Jews are on the one side, very clear that morality matters. On the other side, they allow almost everything. It's very interesting. When it comes to the practice, I remember that scene in Fiddler on the Roof, where they wanted a blessing for a sewing machine, and the rabbi could produce a blessing for a sewing machine. Now, how you get that from the Talmud is quite remarkable, but still, he's able to do it. And I think that my experience of Jewish ethics is that somehow, in the big, broad principles, there's no disagreement. But when it comes to the application, Robert Winston is a very devout Orthodox Jew, and yet he's the leading guy in fertility and throws away human embryos, blinking an eyelid, and you think, what is this? So that's been difficult. Where I've been shocked is with Muslims. I went to speak to the hospital chaplains, and there is one Muslim chaplain in the whole of the UK who came to this conference, and I was slightly taken aback to find this Muslim sitting in the front row. That's how much he didn't really fit in with the Christians who sat in the front row. And so we went through 3 days of stuff. And at the end of 3 days, he came up and he kissed me. Oh, I'm not in the habit of men kissing me, never mind Muslim cleric men kissing me. But anyway, he kissed me. And he said, I just want you to know that I agreed with almost everything that you said. And I was really surprised, because I wouldn't have said that he would have agreed with that. But I found that the Muslims are very keen, because they haven't done a lot of thinking about these issues. And so they're looking for some help at working out religious, moral, principle-based perspectives. And that's where I think there is some hope in the interfaith dialogue, that actually, when we look at who the enemy is, we can actually work together. But the enemy is time, and it is unfortunately going to defeat us. Thank you all for coming.